This is the Muscles and Management Podcast, where we build your body and your business. Talking all things training, sports performance, and business for athletes and aspiring coaches to enhance your training and better your career. Muscles and Management is brought to you by Challenger Strength with your host, Jerry DiFilippo.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 48 of the Muscles and Management Podcast. As always, please throw me a rating, a review, maybe if you're feeling extra generous and have some time, and subscribe. We're just about to hit 100 ratings. I believe we're at 97 as I'm saying this, so that's amazing. Thank you for that. We also just hit 30,000 downloads on the show overall. Again, amazing. I can't thank you guys enough, and never imagined this kind of getting to where it has, so thank you for that. Keeping it short and sweet this week, at least as best as I can. Check out some of the previous episodes. Last week, we had Jim Malone, head strength coach of the Pittsburgh Pirates, on. He was amazing. Just 90 minutes of, you know, experience and perspective from a 25-plus-year veteran in the field. You don't want to miss that. The week before, we had Connor Harris on, going through some of his tweets, talking about a multitude of different topics in sports performance, strength training, speed training, you know, breathing patterns and their effect, the importance of lifting heavy for motor recruitment and gap, you know, building speed, and delving into some of the business end of things for strength coaches who are in that, you know, private sector, just a load of stuff there. So check that out. He was great. And the week before, we had the Q&A episode that I do solo, you know, answering some of your questions that I've let build up in my DMs. A reminder to always send those out to me. I use them and hope to, you know, help with, you know, my answers. And then also going through some of my own tweets. Little bit on today's guest, a little bit of a bio. As many of you know, Matt Tallarico, he is the base running coordinator for the New York Yankees, also serves as he put it, a roving hitting coach. Matt joined in with the Wright State Raiders in August of 2015, after a playing career of his own. He basically increased the regular season base stealing total by 24 in his first year, which is pretty remarkable. And he also raised their success rate up 6%. So basically no extra pickoffs, 6% extra success rate with 24 more stolen bases. Pretty remarkable if you ask me as a first year on the staff. Started out at Dayton in 2011, and spent 4 years there, overseeing offensive production, hitting, base running, things like that. The school set many records and ranked among the nation's best schools in the stolen base category. They actually led the entire nation in steals with 164 bases and an 82, which is really impressive, percent success rate in 2012, which they won a championship. And in his 5 years there, they averaged 102 steals at a 75% success rate. Just remarkable the work that he's done. Led him to start what is known as stealbases.com. Basically just his whole curriculum and what he does to just, or what he has done to develop some of these prolific base stealers at both Wright State and Dayton, and now with the Yankees. I think you guys are going to just love what he has to say. We're talking about, you know, his playing career strategies, what made him want to get into base stealing from what he did in his time playing. We're talking about the role of acceleration in baseball and how prominent it is. We're talking a little bit about the drop step, what goes into that. It's just all around a fantastic episode for speed fans, baseball fans, kids, you know, athletes and coaches who want to, you know, create or become better base runners. Just all around, if you're looking for something anywhere in those lines, if you're just looking to get faster in general, like, you got to check this out because we're talking about a lot of good stuff. So I'm pumped for that. I think you guys are going to love it. As always, please give me feedback, ask questions, share the episode, send it to someone you think that might enjoy it. You guys have been great with that so far. So, you know, same thing as always. And I guess till next time, we'll see you guys. Enjoy the episode. Peace. All right, everyone. I'd like to welcome on Matt Tallarico, base running coordinator for the New York Yankees, assistant hitting coach as well. Matt, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate your time.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it, man. I was doing some research a few weeks ago. I stumbled across your podcast. I think I was a little late to it, But literally every episode I've listened to, I feel like I take a lot from. So I really appreciate you having me.
For sure, and thank you for that. It's been really cool to kind of see the more coaches I have on in kind of our industry and our field, and the more that find it, you know, through those different coaches has been kind of cool, and I get to connect with guys like you. So it's been fun for sure. And as soon as I kind of looked into you a little bit when we, you know, first talked, I was, you know, thrilled to the prospect of having you on and what we could talk about. And, you know, being a guy that's, you know, obviously loves the game of baseball, but also loves teaching, you know, sprint mechanics and working on speed with guys, you know, I thought this would be a sick episode. So kind of pumped to have you on and see what we can come up with.
Well, yeah, again, I appreciate it. I think the key is, I think, giving out good content. I think, you know, that's what you do really well with your guests. And I think, that's why social media was so good for coaches, at least originally. I mean, everybody's just giving good content, and I think that's what you do. I hope that maybe I can add a little to that today, so I'll do my best.
I'm confident in that. I think we got some good stuff, you know, ready to go to talk about. So I think first and foremost, what I kind of wanted to let you run through a little bit for the listeners, and even me, quite frankly, is like your own playing career and, you know, some of your own experiences, you know, a base runner, base stealer. You know, were you personally a good base stealer or a fast runner? Like, give us a little background on you know, kind of what you went through in your career.
Well, yeah, I feel very lucky in the sense that it was like nothing was ever really easy. I think when I look back, I was never really fast up until like high school, even like maybe my freshman or sophomore year. I definitely wasn't really fast. And I can actually remember intercepting a ball in the end zone like my sophomore year of high school. And I got, you know, just somebody ran me down. I mean, straight shot to the end zone. I could remember somebody running me down. I can remember the next day at school, my buddy giving me a hard time. And I'm like, man, why am I not faster? I think as I grew a little bit, I got a little faster, and I can remember my junior or senior year that being something that I was a pretty good runner by then. And then going away to college, I was a good runner. Looking back, I didn't have exceptional speed, but I would say I had good speed. I played small school ball, small school Manchester, now University of College, when I played in Indiana, and I was really lucky to play for some good coaches that taught me a lot about baseball. But more importantly, you know, I didn't know where my career would take me, and they taught me a lot about coaching. I didn't know it at the time, you know, but looking back, I was very fortunate. Rick Aspasset, the head coach there, and Derek Woodley, two guys that really helped me in this journey. So as a base stealer, I can remember always wanting to be a good base stealer, even when I was really little. And then going into college, I tried to utilize it. I think I had, like, my junior year was better than my senior year. I stole quite a few bases, I think, my junior year, but I didn't know what I was doing. And some of that, when I tell you I'm lucky, some of that really helped my coaching journey because it forced me to define when things were going good and then when things were going bad. And I think that's when you learn a lot about yourself. So, yeah, I was okay. Our school was a good school in the sense that it taught me a lot and I learned a lot, and I feel very lucky. So,
yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great point that you make about you know, a lot of coaches can look back and maybe not so much defining moments always, but like defining years of their, you know, own playing careers that maybe push them to, you know, look into things that they were doing or things that would kind of impact their own growth and their own, you know, kind of development. And that definitely kind of, you know, sends them in the direction of coaching, because I can tell you this on my own behalf, like, you know, getting injured playing college baseball, breaking my ankle, going through the rehab, like kind of being a gym rat for the time that I wasn't able to play, like kind of pushed me, you know, towards what I do. So I can definitely relate to that in that sense. And I also think you made a really good point about, you know, seeing what works and what doesn't work. Like, you know, if you don't have or you're not blessed with that elite athleticism, speed, power, strength, whatever it is, as an athlete, you really have to kind of sink your teeth into, you know, the finer points of what helps you succeed, because you know, a lot of what goes into working with, you know, players, especially like if you're looking at the high school level, is like, or even college, like you're not going to always have that group of guys that are, or girls that are blessed with, like, let's say in the case of base running, blazing speed, right? Like you have to kind of see what are the corners we can kind of look into and explore to make sure that we're getting the most out of that talent, right?
Right. No, I agree 100%. I think the best thing that ever happened to me from a coaching perspective, my junior year, I got a hit, and I, you know, going to a small school, you don't play big schools often. And we were playing Notre Dame. When you're an Indiana kid, that's what, you know, that's the big school. It's like if you grew up in Ohio State's a big school, and we got to play Notre Dame, and I can remember getting a hit, and I was going to steal. Like, I wasn't going to waste this opportunity. It was going to be, I can remember getting a lead off and kind of glancing back to the base. For some reason, I got in a rut of doing that. It's called like a slump, I guess. It was I just kind of take a quick glance. When I looked back up, the ball was coming. And it was just nothing I could do. So I got a hit. I got picked off first. And it was like the best thing that happened, because the next day at practice, I think was the first time I was ever coached in base running. And you're talking to a guy that was counted on to run a lot.
Yeah.
So I think if I would have been just, everything was easy, I wouldn't have had that moment. And Derek Woodley got me after practice, and he's like, started talking to me, just some basic stuff that, like, I can remember thinking, man, I was just kind of wandering off the bag until then. No wonder I was insecure. And, you know, that was a big time moment for me. And I think if I would have been just like a great player who was drafted out of high school, who ran and made it to the big leagues, I don't know if I could have defined those moments for you. That's my job now, is to teach. And some of those tools are coming in, you know, over the last, you know, 10, 12 years, they've come in handy for me. So I'm fortunate.
Absolutely. And I think you also brought up a really good point, like, you know, mentioning, hey, you were a guy that was going to be counted on to steal bases, and you really never were instructed on how to do it. And I think I see a lot of that. And I even see athletes that I work with that are, you know, I got kids that are 6'3", 8", 6'4", 8", 6'5" runners that literally just steal bases off the fact that they're really, really fast. And, you know, we're going to get to that in a little bit, but it's kind of cool to think that, you know, what they could do if they actually had, you know, that education or that knowledge of, like, what they needed to do to actually have success combined with that speed, it'd be a pretty dangerous combination.
Yes, definitely. And I think it's coming. I think, you know, in all of baseball, you're seeing, like, pitching side probably started it. Now the hitting side. And I think all the other areas are going to just get better instruction, better coaching, based off of numbers and the new gadgets that we have to help figure this stuff out. So I think the days of not, you know, for if you're a player coming up, I think you're going to get good coaching. It's going to start at the higher levels, and it's going to work its way down, but you're going to get good coaching in everywhere because we're more confident in what we're saying. It makes sense. It makes complete sense. So like, I was given the instruction up to that point, you know, that coaches felt comfortable giving. And it's just going to get better and better and better. And, you know, I'm trying to help that. I'm trying to help define things and not just coach based on, you know, what my coaches told me and what their coaches told them. We've got better equipment now to measure exactly what's happening. We've got smarter people like yourself that are coming out from the, you know, strength and conditioning side that are, you know, giving good ideas that we can now, you know, incorporate that versus, I mean, just think about it. 10 years ago, it was kind of like taboo to lift and play baseball. That was going to make you stiff and slow and all that.
I just feel like I was personally told to lift low weight, high reps to not get bulky, which we know is like not the case at all. Like if you lift high reps, you're going to put some muscle on. It's just funny, like you said. And I'm only 25, so yeah. Imagine how short that wasn't that long ago. Like that, how much has changed in that like 10-year period?
Right. Yeah, it's been pretty crazy.
For sure. So speaking on that end a little more, like as a strength and speed guy, I definitely want to talk to you a little bit about this. What did your speed training, like, and let's take baseball out of the equation for just a second. You know, you were going to the gym, you were going to, you know, run sprints, you know, if that was even something that, you know, a lot of people were focusing on, you know, what were you doing? Were you doing any short sprint work, sled stuff, heavy lifting?
As a player?
Yes.
As a player? Okay. So this was a long time ago, but, I think first you got to be a pretty motivated guy to be able to do that. To like run on your own is tough. I can remember maybe my best speed coach when I was younger was my dad, and he played football in high school, played just a little bit. I think he went to college, maybe got homesick, came home, but I mean, pretty much he was just gonna just get me to work hard. There was no work hard and document it was kind of his thing. Like maybe if we write it down, we could get better. Which I think now was genius, you know, but we'd set up some things in the backyard. I can remember measuring, like, we had enough room to run a 40, and then he made me like I was really lucky, like best dad in the world. He made me like an old school, like football rope, you know, the old school things maybe you see on like Rudy, where he's got like high knees through the rope cords. I had one of those, and he got me a jump rope. And I think maybe his logic was like, if I get him doing all this, maybe something will improve. And I think it did. I think it helped my coordination. And I think, so pretty much I do my rope course. I had the same routine I did every time. I just write down the time I completed it in. I'd do it four or five times. I'd run some 40s. I'd try to jump rope for like 3 straight minutes without hitting my foot. Like that was kind of my plan. So that was probably the earliest memory I have. And then going to college, I do think something that helped was we were tested a lot. We ran a lot for our conditioning. Yeah. And one thing I found was if just running, jogging like 2 miles or 5 miles or whatever did not seem to help at all when we were running wind sprints. So I had like the aha moment of maybe like my junior year of like, maybe I should run more wind sprints, but it was never with the intention of running a faster 60. I just didn't think that way at the time.
And, you just saw correlation, you know, basically.
Yes. Yeah. So that was like my memories of speed training. I worked a lot in the weight room, and I will tell you, I did realize when I could squat more, my vertical was higher. There was a correlation of me like lifting heavier legs and jumping higher. You know, so I'd see the little minor things like that, but by no means did I follow a plan to get faster.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's also you brought up the lifting heavier and you know, seeing your vertical go up, and a quote that I absolutely love from Joseph Potts about I think it was like a month or two ago he tweeted it. It was like, I've never seen I've seen fast runners that don't have high verticals, but I've never seen someone with a high vertical not be a fast sprinter. And it kind of just goes back to, you know, a lot of what I've based, you know, my training with my athletes and my programming early on has been, you know, kind of bump that vertical up. And I could, if I put together like an XY kind of graph with the correlation of, you know, I'll give you an example, having a kid as a sophomore come in as a, you know, 6'9", 7'7" flat runner with like a 25-inch vert who now jumps, you know, a 31.3 and he's running a 6'5", 6", like things like that kind of make it hard to ignore the, you know, benefit of getting the leg stronger, getting the vertical up, and then obviously just mixing a bunch of sprint work with full rest that you kind of alluded to. It seems to have proven to be a good formula, but it's kind of cool, like you said, that's kind of been proven to work more with the numbers we have and the technology to measure these things, and like with the vertical jump pads and all that kind of stuff. So it's been nice to see the paradigm kind of shift on that.
Yeah, and you know, I think those were just like little minor things I think I was like accidentally noticing. But it was weird. At Wright State, where I coached, I just took this job with the Yankees maybe in August. So I was at Wright State years before. I was very fortunate to work with some like stud players that were great athletes too. And all of our fastest guys, I can remember one year asking if they could dunk. And they said, yeah. And I'd say, send me a video. So a lot of times it's like you see me present or something, I'll mix in, part of it will be our guys jumping, how amazing it is, how high they can jump. And they're also like really fast runners. So like I do think, although my work wasn't very intentional, it wasn't for nothing. I do look back and, you know, I had really strong beliefs. So when somebody, you know, like yourself talks about like improving the vertical, I listened to that episode. I don't know when you recorded it. I listened to it, I think, 2 weeks ago. I was like, yeah, that makes total sense, you know, and being able to get more and more explosive. And what an easy goal, instead of worrying about running faster. Oh, great, I got to do all these sprints. It's like, yeah, you're still going to run. You're still going to work on your technique. Sprints are going to be short. Now, let's try to, let's see if we can get you to dunk. So like with a high school guy, that's an exciting goal, you know? So, I do think it makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you mentioned the vertical episode. That was like one of my earlier ones, if I'm not mistaken. Just it's been really cool. Like you mentioned before, like the process of like, as a coach, the more you learn, and like over the last 3 or 4 years, myself personally, like I would, if you would have told me when I was like 20 and I was still playing that, oh, like, you know, we're going to test verticals for baseball players. I'm like, what do you mean? Like the jumping's not important for, I wouldn't have understood the correlation. you know, and then you slowly get to, you know, understand like, okay, it's a general, you know, test of your lower body power, combination of, you know, strength and, you know, elasticity and like loading onto your legs and everything. And like, why, how wouldn't that correlate to sprinting? And obviously we've seen that. Speaking a little more on the short sprint type of stuff, were there any, like, were you or any guys you played with doing, like, you know, 10 or 15 yard sprint work, or was more like, okay, the shortest we went was like 30 or 40 maybe?
No, I can remember. So I can remember wanting to run a better 40 or 60 or whatever I was doing at the time, whether it was football or baseball in high school and then again in college. I can remember like having to mentally talk myself into running the next sprint. And I just don't think that's a good place to be successful. So when I was at Wright State, I would do the conditioning for our guys. And I figured we had all this time, like, we need to mix base running in this conditioning, and we need to have more intentional work that's going to actually get them faster. And pretty much my rules were, we're going to keep them competitive. I think that's the best way to get a guy to actually run 100%.
Oh, yeah.
When you can get them to want to run 100%. I think the other important thing was we kept sprints short. And then the final thing is we kept it technical, where we would ask them to think a little bit. And then the more competitive it got, we'd ask them to think less. And then that's when we'd video to see what we had. But it's amazing, like, when I would run, so you asked me about as a player, or when as a coach earlier, when we have guys run, it's such a thing, like, mentally, they just got to get through it. And I think when you get to, like, I got to just get through it zone versus coach give me one more zone, I think those are very different. So, like, if I'm running with you and you're timing me and we're doing, like, 20-yard sprints or something like that, and I say, hey, just let me get one more, I think I can do better. Nobody ever says that after, like, suicides in basketball. Nobody ever says that with your... when you're running 60s, it's like, how many do we have to do? And I'm not saying there's not benefit. Maybe you could argue like mental toughness, or you could argue like cardiovascular benefits from it. But I wanted to make all our conditioning focused on getting faster. I think in baseball, we're mainly accelerating. We're not in top end speed very much. If we are, we're cutting angles and turning, so it's not really running straight at top end speed.
Yep.
So why not focus on what we're going to do more?
Absolutely. I think that's, it's funny. I do sound bites for these to advertise the episodes. And I just marked down the time we just said that because I think it's a great sound bite. Like, no one's ever run a suicide and said like, oh great, like, how much faster can I go on the next one?
yeah.
You mentioned obviously, like, you know, there is benefit. You know, Bob Alejo talks about it a lot, about, you know, if you never cross that, you know, lactic threshold, so to speak, and aren't used to being having to produce power in that fatigue state, you know, you are going to struggle. And I think a really good way, just in terms of what you were saying, like testing the conditioning or things like that, in terms of like, okay, you're going to run a 30-yard sprint and we're going to, you know, get your max time, right? So let's just say, and I'm going to use a 40 because off the top of my head, I can't think of good times for a 30. But let's say we say, okay, you're going to run a 40 for your max time. Let's say the guy runs like a 4.7, right? We're going to say, okay, we're going to take 95% of that 4.7. So let's say it comes out to like a 4.95 or a 4.9 or 4.85, whatever it is, and see how many rounds they can go doing 40-yard sprints and keeping their time within 95% of their max time. And you give them like a little below maximal or full recovery. And that's a really competitive way to say, okay, like, I did 8 last time, I want to get to 10. And like things like that are like kind of what you were kind of alluding to, like different ways to go about it in the better way that actually makes sense with energy systems. Like, there you go right there. Like, that's a competitive way to say, okay, guys, like, the team average was 7 last time in terms of how many rounds guys could go and keep their sprints up to 95% of their max speed. Let's try to go for a team average of 10. And I think stuff like that is just like kind of making its way more into the industry. And the older guys that I've been in that I've connected with yell at me, or they won't yell at me, but I've heard them kind of allude to this before, like, oh, we've been doing this stuff for years. It's like more mainstream now and everyone wants to act like, you know, it just came out. And I'm like, okay, but maybe 4 or 5% of people were actually doing this stuff back then. So as far as I'm concerned, to 96% of people, this is all new.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with you. I think that's a great way to do it too. What I found was like, again, maybe it was the culture at Red State. But as long as you can find those competitive areas. So what I found was like, I need to divide them up to like speed. And if they're not in like speed groups, like if they're small groups, I need to cheat for the other guys to try to constantly give them somebody to beat, somebody to work against. Promoting guys running their mouth to each other, that's really helpful.
Yeah.
Like if you've talked all day about how you're not, you know, you're going to beat the other guy, you better show up and do it. So I kind of encouraging that without it getting out of line either. But if you can keep them in that, but at the end of the day, if me and you are running against each other, it's my belief that if we're running 60s, we can run them out all day. We run one, it might be competitive. Maybe the second one, the third one, like we're kind of, okay, let's, Coach, how many more are we going to have to do? So that's where I think those short ones come. Like I can truly get closer to 100% more often and versus trying to have guys try to get motivated to do it. Because, you know, as well as I do, most guys aren't that motivated. Even if you are, there's only so much you can do.
Yeah, absolutely. Like there's a limit to anything, but you even mentioned before, like, you know, capitalizing on competitiveness, like, even putting some college guys I work with and making them do sprints two at a time and 10 yards and beat the other guy, making them do sled pushes, beat the other guy. Like you have to find ways to inspire, the younger athletes and like the high school and college age athletes to, you know, have that extra fire in them. And even simple things like, okay, guys, like we're going to time, like you said before, every single sprint that we do, it's like, okay, you know, who's not going to want to run faster in sprint five than they did in sprint, you know, two, three, or four, right? Like, you know, having that competitiveness, keeping that competition, making sure, you know, guys are attentive to just, you know, running hard and running as fast as possible, first and foremost. Like, I feel like so many, you know, high school and college age, I don't think you'd see this as much with, like, a professional athlete, because I feel like at that point, that's kind of, you know, ingrained in them, or even, like, that high-level, you know, Division I player. And, you know, there's the special guys as well that always just, you know, give that effort. But I always find that the hardest thing you know, first and foremost is to just let them understand that, hey, we're only sprinting 10 yards, but like, it's got to be as fast as you possibly can. Cause like, that's the only way we're actually going to get faster is that, you know, we're sprinting at max speed. You know, mechanics are huge and we're going to talk about that like in a couple minutes, but you know, intent can clean up a lot for sure. And as I said, like if you're not trying to run fast or running as fast as you can, getting faster is going to be very tough. Right.
Right. I agree. Definitely.
So I just alluded to mechanics in that, you know, a little bit there. And it was something, that I definitely wanted to touch on with you. And it's something that I'm pretty passionate about. You know, talking about baseball and the dominance that acceleration plays in the sport. And then moving into a little bit of like, you know, the drop step and the mechanical side of things. But, you know, baseball obviously is for the listeners who are baseball, players, coaches, fans, whatever, they know this, but I've talked about it a lot, but baseball is predominantly, you know, acceleration driven in nature. I keep saying I'm going to find this and I have to, but I saw something one time basically talking about like the average major leaguer taking roughly 11 strides to get to second, you know, off their lead from first. And seven of those 11 strides are in acceleration. So you hear something like that and it kind of makes you think like we really have to concentrate, you know, what we're training on and giving that information and not be, like you said before, like worrying about those longer sprints, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I, you know, again, I tried to make that switch a little bit when I came to Wright State. I was at the University of Dayton for 5 years. When I came over to Wright State, I was really blessed to work with a staff that was all about player development. Like we talked about it a ton. Behind closed doors, it was about development. In front of them, it was about development. And that's one thing we kind of revisited. And it took about a year when I was there, but pretty much we went from setting cones out and going back and forth to saying like we could use this time more. More to our benefit just with NCAA, they limit our hours so much. And I thought one of the things, like we talked about, just focusing on shorter sprints, but then also trying to slowly incorporate base stealing with it. So we might talk technique a little bit and what they're trying to do. And then we'd slowly get into competition mode to where they weren't thinking and running. And then we'd have like a cycle of doing that every day. We might get a little more creative here or there, but yeah, it was focused on acceleration Very rarely. Maybe if, you know, we wanted to let them know who was boss and how bad things could be, we might have like one day just to remind you what most teams were going through. But then we were back to work the next one where we're just really focused on, you know, acceleration mechanics. How well can we get off the line? I'm talking about how different ways we could improve that. And then incorporating that into our different leadoffs and our different jump styles.
So you're basically saying like you guys would have times where you're just doing sprint work, let's say in the outfield on the turf, wherever it is, and then you would have other times where you are working more specifically, you know, off of first base or just doing your baseball specific in the sense of like it being on the base paths. Like, how would you say that? Like, that was divided up in terms of what percentage of time was spent in each area? Like,
basically. Yeah, no, I could tell you. Yeah, I can tell you exactly. So pretty much the way the college year worked, which worked out really well for us, is we'd have a certain amount of time in the fall where we could work with guys. We'd have our fall season then, and then we'd have a little time at the end. So really during the pre-fall season and then to our first game, our first fall game, we would be mainly acceleration work, not much on the bases. We still always get a lead off, but that's pretty much where it ends. We don't have a pitcher. We might do some like reaction starts, but we don't have a pitcher out there. And technically, you're not really supposed to with NCAA anyway in some of the workouts that are just conditioning, right? Mm-hmm. So then as that season started, especially for those young guys, in my last few years, we had a lot of guys that were used to the system. So there were only a handful of young guys that I really needed to get comfortable with the basics of getting a lead off and things like that, although everybody still worked on it. So as we got closer to the game, then we'd start to bring that in. And the more veteran our lineup got, the more I utilized some of them to help teach. And I thought that was really powerful. So I found we were getting older. So I'd take those older guys. I'd say, hey, you guys are in charge of this guy. He's got to know the nuts and bolts. He's got to know the system. So we can move on, and that really helped learning. So dividing those up, that was huge for us. And then it allowed us to, you know, kind of shift that. So when we're in a game, we're not thinking about this stuff. We might have small thoughts of maybe our stance or maybe, you know, fast hands or whatever guys like to think when they're out there. But when we were working on just sprinting and accelerating, they were allowed to get technical, and we'd encourage that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that you bring up about, you know, having veterans in the system, you know, getting that ability to get new guys through things a little faster, because you basically had like, if you had, you know, sophomores, juniors and seniors coming back, you know, and you had, let's say, 20 guys that have already been through it, it's like you have 20 assistant coaches basically. And it's like, I see that in the weight room too, like, hey, you know, new guy in today with the group. You know, make sure he knows, understands the right way to do the warm up or the right way to, you know, get into the squat rack and get ready to get things going. And it's like, it helps so much when you teach guys the right way to do things, and you're very detailed and you're like that with them for several months, because then they kind of, you know, it becomes ingrained in them and they know the system. Like you said, you know, it takes a lot of the grunt work away as a coach, where you can really get into the, like you said, the nuts and bolts of mechanics and all that kind of stuff. Speaking of which, in the mechanic sense, you know, we're mentioning acceleration, and a lot of people might like think of this and say, okay, like if you're sprinting, you're sprinting. Like, what's the difference? I don't understand. You know, why do I have to worry about just the beginning of a sprint versus, you know, doing longer sprints? And the basic difference would be the mechanical differences between acceleration in that first like 15 or so yards, and then what is known as top speed or top velocity. You know, which is once you reach that top speed, things change from a mechanical standpoint. So we're talking stride length, you know, angle of acceleration. We've been exchanging some stuff back and forth, talking about a lot of this already. Shin angle, things like that. Like, what would you, you know, stress as the importance of like knowing the differences for somebody that like doesn't have any idea? Like, why is it so important to just focus on acceleration?
Well, again, like you mentioned, I think in most of baseball, if we are at top end speed, we're usually like shifting and turning in some way, like going around the bases.
Yep.
So it's kind of an athletic move. So we're either working on turns, which we'd actually get closer to the base just to like cut down the wear and tear, because I'd rather them do it right than think, oh, God, I don't want to do this. So we're either that. So we're not even really working on top end speed there. And so we'd focus on acceleration when we'd sprint. And the reason why we talk about that and we focus is, like you said, it's just completely dominant in what we're trying to do. So if I force a longer sprint, and I don't think, number one, we're going to lose attention. They're not going to want to be involved in it. And number two, it's just not something that we experience. So we talk about some different things, and we talk about making sure their stance is good. And it depends on the guy. Like, some guys, I want them to know details, and they're, it's kind of like hitting. Like, they're into it. They want to know about it, and we talk about it more. Other guys, I don't think it's good they know about it. They don't want to know about it. They just, like, give me what I need to work on. I'll work on it. And we try not to force the, like, that analytical, all the thoughts on those guys like we would the other guys. We do, again, like hitting, we try to talk about times where we can think about it and times where we're going to have to either go to the right or go to the left and as fast and strong as we possibly can. And if you're thinking about your legs and your drop step and your, you know, all this stuff, it's tough for a lot of guys. So we try to put a big divide in that.
Yeah, like, there's those ones that they're the ones that need it or want it, and there's the ones that if you give it to them, they're going to implode, right? Like, their brain's going to short circuit, and it's going to just, like, be a mess. And then you have those guys that, like, want to come and, you know, like, when I'm at the facility working with guys, like, I'll have the phone out on the slow-mo, you know, mode on the iPhone. And for anyone that thinks it's, like, this, you know, gigantic cutting-edge thing, it's, like, literally, like, filming sprints with even a phone. Like, the slow-mo on the iPhone is just so good with the camera quality these days. Like,
oh, yeah.
You can see a lot. And I have guys that want to come up to me and say, hey, like, I want to look at that. Like, what was my extension like? What was my posture like? And then I have other ones that, like, if I mention those terms, they'd be like, what are you talking about? So it really depends on, you know, what type of athlete you're dealing with. And like you said, hitting's the same way. And there's ones that need it and some that if you give it to them, you know, it's going to be bad. So you have to just really get to know the athlete for sure.
And I think what you just said is good too. Just like I mentioned earlier that, you know, In high school basketball, you never stuck around and asked for video of your last wind sprint because they weren't in the mode. So I would say without seeing your guys run, they're in the mode where they're concentrated getting faster. So a lot of times, we have our team conditioning, but some of the big times are maybe you got a guy that's hurt, you know, and he's not going to play that year, but he's a pro guy. I mean, right, say we had a lot of good athletes. We had really, really good at, I mean, very rarely did the team we were playing have better, just like raw players. We got to where it was going pretty good. And so we had situations where somebody may be hurt for a year and we knew he was going to be a draft guy eventually. And he's a highly motivated guy. So when he comes to you and says, hey coach, like it's important that I can run a good 60 if I want to get paid. Yeah. And then you sit down and you work with some of those guys. And that's the environment where we could treat them a little more like a sprinter, like in track. Than we would in a different situation because he doesn't have to worry about playing. Yeah. So when we talk about lifting certain ways and running certain ways and focusing a little more versus if he had to play that night, it just, we'd rather you get out there, run hard and not get picked off.
Yeah. Well, it's just like you said, like when you can strip baseball away from it for a little bit, and I think that's important too. Like, you know, I have a young 14-year-old that I've been working with for a little over a year now, and we've like totally revamped his mechanics with sprinting. And, you know, obviously the influx of power and strength has just been a lot on him in terms of, you know, the impression it's made on his mechanics and everything. But, you know, talking to him about like, okay, like we're running resisted sprints and now we're going to do some unloaded ones afterwards. We're going to go in a regular sprinter start. He's like, all right, like, why aren't we doing a baseball start? And I'm like, dude, you spend so much time in that position. I need to take you away from baseball a little bit and just make you a better sprinter. Then we'll go every so often, we'll go back and work on that drop step and we're going to get to the drop step and everything. But we get to that baseball start, the drop step, like the specifics of that starting position. But like, I also have to, the other 9 yards that I have to, 15, you know, 14 yards that I have to work on with you. Like, you know, getting to second base is more than just, you know, getting out of your lead, out of your baseball start, getting from first to third is like there's the actual generic, general sprinting components of it as well. So I think you bring up a great point. It's like when there's, you know, the ability to strip that away and let them just be sprinters and like that track sense, it can be really, really huge and be really helpful for a lot of guys.
Right. I agree.
So speaking, and you mentioned the 60, and I don't want to get off on a tangent. I'll get like upset about this because it pisses me off, but like, thinking of the percentage of a 60, and I'm going to run these off the top of my head, so if you're listening, forgive me if I screw these up, but looking at a 60, right? Like if we say, would you agree, generally speaking, like 15 yards is that acceleration zone roughly? Like up until, like
well,
how long it takes
to, and
it depends, like how long it takes each guy. But
depends how powerful the guy is. I agree. Something around
generally,
the first section of that. Yes.
Yeah. So let's say 15 yards. We take that out of 60. You're looking at like 75% of your 60-yard dash is top speed, right? We literally just talked about the fact that like the rarity of being at top speed, and if you are, you're angling or cutting. Like, just one, to get this out to the open, how dated the test is and how it makes really no sense. And I have people argue with me all the time, like, oh, if you're fast in top speed, you're fast in anything. I mean, I don't care. Like, I want to know how powerful a guy is in the first, 8, 9, 10 yards for even more than just base running, moving laterally in the field, whatever it is. But all that aside, looking at those differences, like we said, I said 7 strides out of the 11 to get to second base for the major league, average major leaguer. 7 of the 11 strides are acceleration. It's like 65%. How backwards is it that we're testing guys in a 75% top speed test when, getting first to second to steal a base, which is one of the most valuable commodities in the sport, is 65% acceleration?
Right. Well, okay. So I disagree with you and I agree with you. So
okay.
Here's the thing. If I look at it from a recruiting standpoint, and one of my favorite people, his name's Nate Metzger. He's still the recruiting coordinator at Wright State. Like, just great guy. And we used to have these talks, right? Because we're on the road together. We're in, whether we're playing or recruiting, we just talk about this stuff. Like, what do we like? What don't we like? So we'll talk about bat exit velocity testing. Why we like it? Why we don't? 60s would come up. And Nate would make a good point where he would say, hey, I just want consistency. Like, he could take a 60 and measure it back against a guy he recruited 7 years ago that ended up playing.
That I agree with 1,000%. It's really good for comparisons. And I guess, and I left this out, so it's really good that you mentioned that. Like, that's a one that's really, really a fair point. Because, like, what are we going to compare a 30 to if we just start doing them now? Or, I'm sorry, if we did 10s or 15s, we don't have any data. Like, Perfect Game, PBR, like, all these recruiting services, all these camps and schools, like, they have reams of data over decades for guys in the 60. So, tremendous point in terms of that. I guess I would say just maybe think, like, I'm tailoring it more to saying just the effectiveness of the test compared to the sport, maybe.
Right. I agree with you on that for sure.
So that was a really good point, that you brought up, though, for sure.
I did feel like, what we started doing, and we started doing this back maybe when I was coaching at Toledo or I think at Dayton, we had guys at camp, like a lot of times, especially now, like if you like the guy, maybe you can get him to a camp, maybe a weekday camp, or maybe you catch him at a weekend camp. And like if at our camps, like if you came to where I was coaching, like we were going to run what we'd call a steel start. So not only were we going to run 60s, we were going to run those because they're not really 60s taxing. Like if you run 2 or 3 of those, the guy might be sore. It's something about adrenaline. When they run, like the next day, our guys are always hurt and their backs are always tight, all that stuff. Steel starts usually are generally pretty easy on them. So we'd run less 60s. Maybe you run one. Maybe if somebody, runs a really good one, you might ask them to run it again just to make sure everybody's stopwatch is working. And then we'd run like a couple more steel starts than we would 60s, because there are guys that can run fast 60s and they get in their steel start and it's not the same.
Yes.
And vice versa.
Yes.
So to answer your question, I agree with you. I do like being consistent, because one of the questions I get with steel starts is, why don't you have them slide? Why do you know, there's better ways I could do it. I agree. A friend of mine with the Indians was asking me that. He said, why don't you have them slide? And I said, well, I don't have a good answer for you, except when I first started doing it, we didn't slide because I was at a Division III school running on a gym floor.
So now you're comparing it.
I want to compare my, I want to know right when a guy runs it, like, oh, he could be like him, or he's the fastest I've ever had, or he's slower than I thought he'd be. So that's just the way we've done it.
I think,
and I kind of like it, although the system's faulted.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. Like, and again, like you mentioned the consistency of it. I think the only thing I would say to that is I would basically start, I think this is the only way you could really ever start to make a change, is to have the 60 still be run, but like start to have guys run the 60 and then like a 10 or a 15 yard sprint, or I'd say 10 yard sprint. It's pretty universal. Like a lot of people are doing it now, like have that included in it. And then after 5 or so years, start to like phase out the 60 and like be like, all right, like now I have 5 years of 10 yard sprint data to break down, or 20 yard sprint data to look at. Because I look at it in a sense of like, you know, 50 years ago, the average, you know, gym teacher, average, you know, team might have had a guy test his body weight on the bar for as many reps as possible. And, you know, now we're looking and saying, you know, okay, they're in an anaerobic sport, a max output sport. Like, I'd rather know what their 3 or 5 rep max is maybe, or like even like the bench press, 25 rep tests, on the bench in the NFL. And that gets a lot of, you know, a lot of flack from people saying like, all right, you're talking about an anaerobic sport where like maybe about is 5 to 7 seconds at most from a lineman. Like, why do I care, you know, how much you can bench 225 for? I'd rather know like what he can bench, you know, 2 or 3 reps for if it's a higher weight. And you can make the argument too, like, all right, if you can bench 225 for 40, your max is higher than a guy that can do it for 30. Like, there's all the arguments like that. But I guess my point would be like, maybe find a way eventually to phase certain things in so you have that consistency like you alluded to. But, you know, maybe you're getting things to be a little more effective. It there's pros and cons to it all.
Yeah, I think it's kind of funny. We make them, and again, you can't change this because it messes with consistency, that we make them run that far and they have to start in a base stealing stance as it's like, as it's going to relate to the game. Like, well, we're going to make it like baseball.
Yes, I never even thought about that.
Great for getting a base stealing stance. Just let the kid get in a track stance if he wants, you know?
But yeah, and then you get into all the, we're going to talk about the drop step. Like, if you're running a laser timer, you know the implications that could have on, like, you know, you pick your foot up and put it down and it doesn't cross the laser yet. Like, you have a big advantage.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's
like,
true.
You could tell a kid, like, hey, man, the laser's on the white line. Like, advice for you would be to start 6 inches behind it so you could pretty much have a stride already going before the laser goes off. It's like, we have to think about these things.
Yeah, definitely.
And then you look at the opposite. Yeah. If you have a stopwatch, coach is going off your first move. It might hurt you to do a drop step.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, mechanically, it makes more sense.
I love steel starts. If they said they were changing them, like, I don't have to – it doesn't matter to me anymore because, you know, not in college anymore. But, like, I would have loved if they would have changed it to steel starts. And I'd be kind of the rare guy that would stand there. As somebody I was recruiting, I wouldn't do it for everybody. But if they did get on base, you know, and got a jump, I would time their in-game steel start. We get access to so much information with the Yankees now. It's pretty awesome, like seeing what a guy's first movement is and his reaction time off the pitcher. And you just get all that information. I was trying to do it by hand, but I do think you could get a guy in high school, maybe like a 7-0 guy or something like that, that you're not real pumped about his speed. And all of a sudden, Nate, actually the guy I was telling you about, Nate Metzger, sent me a text the other day asking, he said, you know, hey, this steel start didn't match up with his 60. You like that? And I said, yeah, I think that's a good thing. Like, you know, just see how he moves, see what you think. And sometimes you get those guys where it's like, yeah, this guy's a sleeper. Like, he plays the game faster than he is.
Yeah, for sure. Well, even think about it. Like, let's say you have a big, strong first. Let's say you have a first base that's like a 6'4", like 230 guy. Like, he's big, like big, big guy, like powerful, right? Let's say he runs a 7'3" in a 60. But – and I'm gonna, and I know this because I work with linemen in football. Like, I know linemen that can run next to my defensive backs and be very close to them in a 10 because the strength and the power they have is off the charts, but they just don't maintain it, obviously, at the top speed, right? If I have a first baseman that runs a 1.55 10-yard sprint but then runs a 7.4, I'm going to be pretty happy because I'm going to say, all right, like, off his – like, moving laterally at first base to get to balls, like, how good is he going to be and how effective is he going to be off that first step? He's really powerful. Like, why would I get caught up in the last 30 yards of a 60? Like, for that person, like, it doesn't – you're going to tell me you're going to denounce a big, you know, bulky, powerful, strong first baseman because he runs a 7.4?
Yeah. No, I think if he's that big and strong, it's kind of like – I don't know, you're getting him hoping he can hit, but I was lucky enough that I had a guy that was very similar to what you're talking about. He's with the Twins right now, and those are kind of my favorite guys, believe it or not. It's the big guy that's deceptive,
Those guys are really fun to work with. And especially if their whole life they've been told they should play an unaggressive style. Yeah. Because when I get to work with them and we talk about some of these things, and I show them why I think they can be good, and I show them some methods that I think they could practice. And once that clicks, it's fun watching them play a brand of baseball that's like, wait, this guy shouldn't be able to play like this. But you see it. It's more rare. You're talking about teaching feel. And I think too often we set limitations and we shouldn't. And some of those guys, you're right, if they're quick in short sprints and short bursts, I mean, they can really do damage because people don't expect it. So you can sneak quite a few on them. And I think if you look at him, like in most schools, his career, he would have gone down as one of the better base stealers in the career. Now, it didn't happen at Wright State because we had a lot of fast guys that could do the same. But he had a really good career as far as base stealing because you just sneak on people like that.
Yeah, and think about it. Like you mentioned, you had a guy just like it. But like, if that guy runs a 1.5 something 10-yard sprint, like he's very elite in the 10, and with their stride length because they're taller and they have long limbs, they're going to be at second base very quickly. Like people don't realize that, and they would write a guy off for, like you said, being deceptive, like, oh, he runs a 7.4, like cement shoes, like he's not going to be a threat or be a guy that's going to run at all. It's like you'd be surprised with like the long limbs and the power in the first 10 yards. Like you could put something together with that, with the right approach on the base pads for sure, and obviously that's stuff that you do. Talking a little bit about we're mentioning the stride length, like stride length is key in the first 10 yards. And I'm very influenced by Joe DeFranco. He talked a lot about when he would get guys ready for the NFL Combine. A guy like Jim Finn, who was the longtime fullback for the Giants, ran maybe 6.5 strides in the first 10 yards. And if he got him down to 5.5 strides, his time, went down, pretty drastically. So in acceleration, that stride length is key. The ground contact's a little longer because you're getting going. You're on a bit more of an angle, a little steeper, 45 degrees more so than like being tall and top speed. The shin angle kind of follows suit. From what you've seen and like what you've done, whether it's been in your own playing career or what you've seen with guys you work with as a coach, how important, and we already mentioned relative strength a little bit and power, but how important is, the things like the sled work and, improving the strength in your first couple strides, your relative body strength, in that first 10 yards of acceleration, getting, out of your stance. How important is that?
I think it's real important. I think in college, in pro ball, you get a unique view because you get these guys when they're kids. So, I mean, I'm not even talking about the weight room. I'm just saying general maturity, when guys get stronger, and it's really clear. And I'm sure you see it a lot when you work with an athlete that's in high school that hasn't quite grown yet. And like, he's trying so hard. When he runs, it's just not there. It's just not powerful enough. He just needs to grow. And it's not like he's just going to have to wait it out a little bit. We're going to get the technique better, but eventually it'll click. And I think in college you get to see that. So like a lot of guys, freshman to sophomore year, they'll come back and you can tell they're just a lot more powerful. I think one interesting indicator, I don't know what you think of this, but one interesting indicator is guys that want to slide head first when they're stealing. I generally think those guys start out really powerful, and they're guys that run a little more like track guys where they'll bury their head. They're not so much looking around, looking for the target, looking in. It's like, well, your body tells you kind of, it's weird. I don't know how to explain it, but your body tells you what slide to use. Like you can't explain
your position,
it. Like,
as long as you, that for sure. I would agree. Yeah.
And guys that really want, as long as they haven't been hurt, and that's not why they're doing it, but guys that really want to slide foot first, I feel like they don't accelerate as far. I feel like they enter top end speed too early, and their body's telling them that this makes sense, versus our powerful guys keep that angle longer. Mm-hmm. And I do think like when you watch like Ricky Henderson slide, how powerful his head first slides were.
Oh, it looks like he's about to like rip the base off. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've never thought of that. That's really interesting.
I love listening to Ricky Henderson. Like growing up when I did, everybody loved Ricky Henderson, especially me. I mean, I used to, I can remember having his cards, and I love Ricky Henderson. I can remember his talking on some interview I was watching. It said that he was on an airplane they were going down. There was a lot of turbulence. They weren't going down like crashing, but you could tell it was going to be like a rough landing. And he said there were no bumps. So on the way out, he walks in to talk to the pilot and he says, "How'd you make that so smooth?" And he said, "I tried to get lower to the ground and I keep going. Like I don't slow down. So he's like, so I started applying that." And they just show clips of him like sliding like a maniac through bases. But I do think he was onto something. I think sometimes when you're hitting, you can talk about the end and everything will line up to get to the end. And I think in a way, base running is like that. It's like, make sure you slide hard head first. And all of a sudden they accelerate a little further. Yeah, I don't have science backing that up. But
no, I think tell it, you, I'm visualizing it in my
college
head.
Guys.
I'm visualizing it right now. As soon as you said it, I started thinking about it. And hear me out on this, if this is a way to kind of make it, you know, be something people can actually like, be like, oh, like it's more than just, you know, what he, you know, a thought that you had. I'm thinking about it this way. If you're on a good acceleration angle, we want all of your energy. We talk about being linear, right? Like your energy's got to be going towards, you know, the direction you're running in. And the big part of acceleration is you get on that angle because you want to build momentum and overcome gravity, right? Think about it like,
right.
If you are really getting a good angle, it's naturally going to feel better to slide head first because your energy is going that way versus if you pop up to top speed too soon. You know, when you slide feet first, it's like the feet go, you're kind of, your chest kicks back a little bit. You're in more of an upright start position at top speed. It fits better. So I think that makes tons of sense. Yeah. And now that I'm like thinking about it, I think that's a great point.
Yeah. You know, I don't make anybody do it, but we strongly encourage, you've got to know your slide type. And I don't want to go down this trail until you want to talk more about base scaling specifically, but I think kind of fits because we talk about slide types and most people don't really talk about it. You just do what you do. But we like slide 101 is a head first slide right through the bag. You're not grabbing unless you can see feet in front and you pop up over the bag. And the only way we slide foot first or feet first is when we know we're safe. Like we know we're safe, but we're not 100%. It's not like we saw a pass ball because that's generally when people get hurt. So instead of going in without sliding the second, we'll pop up slide because we can pop up and look around. And that's the template. Now, does everybody do that? No, but I would say the majority of times, if you'd watch my teams, hard head first slides without like wasted movement reaching, because you see a lot of like, I veer off to the left, veer off to the right without a tag. It's just kind of the cool thing to do. And infield tags are quick if they let the ball travel, and that crushes you. So like we do talk about that. So when back to your acceleration, I do think some of just promoting that, you'd see guys clean it up from the freshman to sophomore year.
Yeah, absolutely. And even things like, you know, maturity, like you said, bringing on that strength and that power. But like I referenced this 14-year-old a lot because like I work with him a lot and I have a lot of evidence from what we've done, you know, and everything like that. Like the ability, like the things you can do, like with the knowledge that we have now as coaches of being able to increase the power that gets put in with strides, like, you know, pulling a sled, you know, into a sprint that's just heavy enough to make you exert more, you know, force into the ground, but light enough that you can move it fast. Like there are studies all over the place and I'm actually going to shoot this over to you, but there are studies that have proven like the ideal, you know, percentage of weight, you know, on a sled being anywhere between like 65 to, you know, 99% of your body weight. And that being like the ideal power zone. Like if you go any heavier than that, like you can't really maintain the right, you know, mechanics of acceleration. It kind of interferes. And any lighter than that doesn't really make you exert enough force. And I have kids ask me all the time, like, what, how do the sleds, like if I, you know, put a guy, it's 170 pounds and he's got 62 pounds on each side of the sled, like 100% of his body weight between the sled and the weight on the sled. They say like, hey, how is this making me faster? And I explain to them, I'm like, listen, a lot of acceleration that we've already mentioned this is, you know, putting more force into the ground. Like the guys who can do that, you know, are better accelerators because that's, you know, a lot of what it takes is, you know, getting yourself going with more force. If you put a sled on your back and you have to pull that, what do you think your legs are going to have to do when you put them into the ground? They're going to have to pull more weight than what your body weighs and you're going to have to put more force. So things like that, like I've really come to love like the last like 18 months, you know, a year or so of coaching. Like I use sleds now for sprints more than I ever would have 3 or 4 years ago. So it's pretty cool to see like how effective they are.
when you asked about Fresno, when once you brought it up, I realized I didn't answer that at all. So really, in college especially, you know, we had a great strength and conditioning coach that would do more of that, and he liked that stuff for sure. When they got to me in the field, at the field where we chose to do most of our conditioning, I leaned towards bands and things like that. Yes. For no other reason except convenience, and we didn't have enough sled. I did think about trying to make one, because that's what you got to do when budgets, you know, I'd rather buy a hack attack than a sled, to be honest with you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And so, like, I did think, like, man, could I like, screw something into a cafeteria tray, or, like, how could I do something where we could drag it, push it? But the bands were just there, and they were convenient, and they kind of got the point, you know, if I put a band around a guy's waist, he tends to drive off the back leg better than if he's standing with no weight. So a lot of times I'd use it just to make the point. And that's just because I had that kind of support with Cole over in the strength and conditioning department, that he was hammering that stuff out, which that's why, I mean, at a Division I school, or really I would say most colleges now, you're fortunate to have that. But I love them. I love sleds. I actually bought one from Rogue the other day. I have a place here at my house where I train some guys, and I got a sled, one of those, like, you can push it, you can hook it, you can drag it. I think they're great.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned a good point too. Like, I tell kids all the time, like, they love how they feel if they do a sled sprint, like maybe 3-4 each leg, whatever it is. And they go to do an unloaded one afterwards, and they're so potentiated and so fired up, like, nervous system wise. And, you know, they just been grooved to put all this power in the ground with the heavier sled, and you take it off and they're flying. And the dads and right. The kids look at me, they're like, oh, like, I got to do this before I go to a showcase. I'm like, all right, well, you're not going to be able to drag a sled in a showcase. Like, maybe let's, like, go get a band and you can hook it around the fence and run against it a few times. Oh, that's a good idea. I'm going to do this. So it's like, right, it's like to what you said, convenience wise, like, and for those listening, if you're looking for a kind of like a quote unquote hack to running, you know, being timed at showcases or camps, you know, get a band and, you know, a rogue resistance band or whatever company you use, and hook it to the fence around your waist, and, you know, take 3 or 4 or 5 strides, you know, against that band, and you'll be surprised what, you know, a difference it makes.
Yeah, I can remember I did that my high school junior year. My dad took me to the football track, and I ran, like, I forget how many 60s, because we were gonna put it on our whatever we'd send out to coaches. And I can remember I ran like I couldn't believe how good of a 60 I ran. And if you look at my warm up, it was just like there was resistance stuff in it, and I guarantee that was the reaction I was getting, which is, there's a lot more evidence of support now than back then.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. Getting a little bit in, and I don't want to get too much in, I've talked a lot about it on Twitter, but I do want to have you kind of give your take on it. Just talking about the drop step a little bit, and this brings arguments up with a lot of people still. Just what are your beliefs on it? Why is it, you know, why is it effective? And what are some of the things that it achieves in terms of, you know, why we do it?
Yeah, I think, you know, probably like 5 or 6 years ago, we'd start talking about it more, and you'd see it. I think some of the things we coach in baseball, I can remember coaching outfielders, and I can remember that, like, by the book, the instruction to field a ground ball, come up clean and throw it is just not realistic. Like, I'm doing it right now when I'm standing. It's probably hard to explain over the podcast, but, like, your 1 foot's out in front, and then you, like, magically can get rid of it, like, superhuman. And it took forever.
I played outfield. I never did that. I agree. I used to, like,
do, you know what I'm talking about.
I used to do, like, the little stop off to the side where I'd kind of field it and shift my body away for myself. I would never, you know how they used to tell you, like, pretend you had a funnel coming off your shoe, and, like, you would put your glove right in front of your foot and, like, run through it and do the perfect, I could never do that. If that's what you're saying, now, then I get what you're saying.
Yeah, and it's gone now. Like, people have kind of accepted that, and they stopped coaching it. But I feel like sometimes baseball just hangs on to things a long time, and this is, I think, that crossover step's one thing that's just here. And I think if you know, around enough people that know what they're doing and they can explain why, I think it makes sense. You don't have to fight it. Now, when I handle it, again, I want in-game results. So, like, for me, if the guy thinks he crosses over, I'm okay with it. I do want to teach him the correct way. I want him to understand what's going on. But if that's what he thinks is going on, somebody posted, maybe it was something through your thread, or maybe even you, D. Gordon, posted something talking about a crossover stuff.
I posted, that was me very pissed off one night. Okay. I was upset that people were like arguing with me. Like, it was one of those things where, I had this whole, I'm going to have Dallas on the show. So, a little bit of a preview on that. I got into like an argument with Dallas Braden. People were like flooding my mentions on Twitter with, Dallas basically, you know, took a video of Acuna stealing, second in one of the, NLDS games and gets thrown out. And Dallas is like, oh, like this is clearly why he got thrown out. Like, you know, he picked up his foot and put it down and it's wasted movement, whatever. I go at him, then the argument shifted towards, you know, oh, the pitcher can sense it. I'm like, that wasn't nearly the point of what I was trying to make. It was that, like, it's wrong to say that that made him slower. I was like, let's just get that out of the way. Like, that's just incorrect. So I'm going into this. A lot of, like, you know, 90% of my followers are enjoying it. They're supporting it. You know, they follow me for that reason. They know what I believe in and what I talk about. But I had people, as it started to get more retweets that didn't know me, that insisted on arguing with me. Like putting videos in of like, you know, here's Billy Hamilton and D. Gordon explaining how they run. And they're literally in the video telling you that you need to cross over because if you pick your foot up and put it down, it's incorrect. And I'm like, okay, I went on and I found 30 or so clips of those two guys not doing that, right? And I put the two and two together. I put a side clip and a pick stitch of, you know, D explaining what he thought he did and then what he actually did. And I said, be careful of listening to what people think they do and look at what they actually do. So if that speaks to your point 100%, and that was me with the D Gordon picture, saying like, don't throw that at me. Like I wouldn't post this stuff if I didn't do so many hours of like watching tape on what the guys do. Like I'm not that stupid. It's like, give me a little credit. Right.
Right. And I think it's a lot like hitting. I think when you get some of these hitting guys talk about what's not literally happening, I think a lot of it is like, hey, look, if we get loaded correctly, you don't have a choice. You're going to do what your body, what you line it up to do. I always say it's like flying a rocket. Like it's all in the prep work. And I think, you know, every once in a while I have to get more detailed, but generally my troubleshooting, especially in those conditioning times I was telling you about, is the first thing I'll go for is like, are you in a good stance that allows everything to go properly? Where's the tension? And then I'll kind of break it down from there. But again, if like we think some things like, you know, that our hands start the whole process just because that's something quick that we can think about. And some guys like to think it. So although it's not literally what happens, they can think it. But yeah, so we'll talk about our guys. The guys that I coach are very aware of what they do. But I don't know if they would say what their feelings were in the moment. In fact, I would like that if in the moment they couldn't even tell you, I don't even think about it. Usually that's the best. Like, I don't know how I start. I just get going and maybe I stay low or maybe I get my knees up or maybe I get my arms aggressive in my first few steps or whatever. Something simple is generally good. So we'll start very aggressive with the movements and teaching them how to do it. And then we back off quite a bit. But I can remember, watching guys do it in the same way you would, like, because I was taught to cross over. I always tried to cross over. And so you hang on to that, just so you don't, it's human nature. You hang on to it. And then the more guys I would see when I'd study as I first started coaching, and then, you know, you'd hear, I think Lee Taft used to talk about it quite a bit. He did some experiment, like one of his old videos, which I like a lot of his stuff. It's been helpful, but he'll have guys stand at the line, and then he'll tell them to go, and the people behind him, like they'll stand with their feet square, and the little kid behind him would just watch his feet, and he'll say, wait, why didn't he step forward first? And they'd always catch their weight and go. But if you look at it, it's like defensive backs do it. Everybody does it. And then this might have been you too. I think it was it wasn't you. It was somebody else. And I feel real bad. I can't remember their name or their Twitter. But they posted like a squirrel or a dog. Like if you watch my dog, they do the same thing.
It's Someone replied to one of them. I'm remembering someone put a squirrel replying to one of my posts. I think about the Acuna thing saying, oh, look, the squirrel even does it. Like, It literally dropped its front legs.
Awesome video.
Casey
Deitch sent it to me, who works with us, who's an awesome coach.
I'm almost positive that's what it was. I remember that myself, actually.
Yeah. So I saw it and I saved it. I bookmarked it. It's just such a great, great shot of it. But yeah, I think, you know, getting guys in a good setup, generally guys will swear they don't do it, and I'll play their own video back to them. I'll be like, yeah, you do.
Yeah. And so, it's just, I think, go ahead.
I was just going to say that resistance helps too. That's really good. If I put their back leg up or something like that, or put them on a knee, I know we talked about that a little bit. That's helpful.
Yeah.
Putting a band around them, that's helpful. And that, I mean, it's helpful for sprints and things like that, but it's more helpful in getting the body and saying, like, can we move on? Like, let's not talk about this anymore.
Yeah, it's
not me and
time.
You, but me and the player, any more than we have to. Like, I just don't, and even as a coach, it's like, just don't coach it out of them. Like, don't do anything where you're like trying to anchor their foot down or something to make sure they cross over, you know, because in my mind, if you, and I don't know if you can visualize the same thing I'm doing, but in my mind, if we could actually achieve a crossover, which even most of those guys still kind of pivot a little bit, we pull our posture up. It's just hard to bury our head and get our shoulders out in front doing that. So that's kind of what I think. And yeah. I know it's a sensitive topic, just like hitting or pitching was when nobody liked weighted balls or edutronic or whatever was
out, right?
coming in.
Yeah,
and it's same with hitting. It's like you've got to be able to do both.
Yeah, for
to
sure.
me, like you got to be able to do both. You got to have respect for what somebody that's really fast is saying, and respect for the feelings that they're having. But you have to, you know, you have to look into what's going on. And if you want an opinion on it, get to work. You know, study, see what you know, work with some guys, and then come out. And if you still have that opinion, then I think it's very valid. But don't just say, I don't agree with no research behind it. That's my only thing. Like,
yeah.
Come at me with some research.
Well, even like you mentioned hitting, like I see it all the time. Like, oh, like this guy said he brings the knob to the ball. He's not doing that. His barrel's getting rearward. I'm not even going to get into that whole thing. But like, I think in hitting, there's more gray area to say, like people can interpret things. We see it all the time. There's a whole wing of hitting, the hitting culture out there that literally will tell you things are going on in a video that you don't see. They're like, you just can't see it.
Yet. Right.
I'm not going to get into who it is. It's more drama that it's worth, but you know what I'm talking about and listeners will know what I'm talking about. But like, they're like, you, this is what's going on. You just can't see it. I think base running and sprinting, like, it's really black or white. Like, if a guy picks his foot up and puts it down, it's really hard to say, like, oh, he's not doing that. Look, I'm showing you a video that shows that says he literally picks his foot up and puts it down. So I do think the one benefit for us is that there is, it's like, it's either being done or it's not. And like, it's hard to dispute once you see it. So thankfully that's the case, because it would lead to a lot more arguments about it. I think like a lot of people see the videos of who does what and the studies behind it that are being done. And, you know, talk about studies like, you know, Austin Wasserman has a great one out there. Kevin Poppy, you know, from DST Houston has shared some stuff with me. There's a study that's a couple major league teams have had, you know, access to, and they share it amongst the organizations about like the benefits of the drop step and all that kind of stuff. So I think the information's out there. Like you said, you know, let's respect, you know, the elite base runners, base stealers and sprinters, like what they thought they were doing, but you know, have that, and that's nice, but also understand, like, hey, like, this is what actually was going on, and this is what we need to work to, and we just need to understand that it comes down to, you know, pure mechanics, getting your center of mass over your front side, you know, getting the energy, you know, linear, like we said, towards your target, and not standing straight up. Like you mentioned, you know, crossover steps kind of get you to pop up a little bit. You know, it's the best way to go when moving reactively, and what would you say? How many times, and even if we narrowed it down to just baseball, how many times are you able to fully shift onto your front leg and load up your toe with your knee going over your toe to be able to, you know, not drop step versus how many times you're just running reactively? So, like, that's just what it boils down to, really.
Right. No, I agree.
So, you know, I think that, you know, we can move on from that. I think I'm happy, honestly, like we talked about it from more of like a philosophical coaching, like what to look for standpoint and the mechanics, because I talk about that stuff all the time, and I think it gives a different perspective, you know, for the listeners. But kind of gearing up and moving a little bit more towards like the nuts and bolts of your, you know, mindset and, you know, improving the mindset for stealing bases. This is kind of the part of the show where I kind of just let you, you know, rip the mic away and take over because I'm not a base running expert by any means other than just sprint mechanics. But I want to kind of talk to you a little bit about, you know, what went into or what the process is that, you know, that is steal bases, your whole site and what goes into that process and kind of like what kind of got you, you know, started with it.
Yeah. Well, stealbases.com is my website and pretty much, at the end of my first year with at Red State, I can remember talking to my good friend, Brian Harrison, at the end of a presentation that I did in Ohio. And, I had all this video because it was my first year at a new place and I knew that I was going to be presenting on this. And I wanted to show that maybe hopefully if I could recreate a little bit what we did at Dayton, that I would have that information. So I videoed a lot. And when I spoke at the event, I used like maybe 10% of the video. The other was just going into storage. And then I started organizing it. And at Red State, we had a really good year stealing bases. I want to say we stole 100 and just over 100 bags, which had been the most they had done in a long time.
And you think you reduced the rate, from what I read, you reduced the rate of being thrown out. Like you stole more bags and the rate in which you were thrown out went down too, like 9% or something like that mm-hmm. that I read.
Yeah. So if you watch this play, it depends what day you get us on. So like, if you watch us play, you might leave thinking like this was some of the craziest stuff I've ever seen. And then you might see us another day where it's not as crazy. It's like it's very normal. And it just depends on what we see. So a lot of it's educating the player. But, you know, after that first year, we returned some of those guys back. We had a young team that year that was really good. We returned some of those guys back. So it was their second year. They're getting better. And I think we stole 130 some. So I think we were third in the country. And then my third year, we brought a lot of those guys back. And again, we had a really good year. Last year, we had set a bunch of records. We were second in the country. But pretty much what I believe in is giving a guy a tool set, like a Swiss Army knife. So me and you are different players and we're different people. And we have that stuff. When I said we draw that line between technique and playing, it's because I need you to have this Swiss Army knife full of options. And a lot of times when you do some of the movements we do, it fixes you mechanically, like shuffling into sprinting. A lot of times it mechanically, they're a little more explosive after that. It's like they get a plyometric shuffle in before that. And we can really cheat the system.
Yeah.
So if you watch us, you'd be like, man, these guys are going to get picked off. What's going on? But there's a lot that goes into being able to move. There's a lot that goes into being able to stay in a position where you can go right and left. So we start building this Swiss Army knife from the first day you step on campus. And now it'd be from when you get drafted. And we talk about what you have right now and what we feel like we can add and who you can be successful on, because I really believe everybody can have a role stealing bases. That role might be, you know, once every month. If you're a slow catcher, you're just looking, you just need to know who you can use your weapons on. And it might be every single time you're on base. So last year, I mean, think about this. We had a kid, JD Orr, who stole 60 bags in 59 games. He led the country by a lot. And like, he's a great runner, but if you go back to his career, it took him a little bit to develop that skill set. So like his first year, he stole 7. He played every day, he hit 360, and he was 7 for 14. That's not really good. 50%, they would tell you, you're crazy for letting the kid run. But I would argue base stealing specifically is something that can be developed. So they'd look at it and say the 50%, but that investment made it so the next year he stole 16, which made it at probably 80-some%. The next year he stole 34 at higher percentage, and this year he stole 60 and led the country. And then he goes into Pro Bowl, and I think he led I think he was in New York Penn League last year or for rookie ball. So like, it pays off if you develop it, or you could look at him and say, he just doesn't have the instinct. So that's pretty much what we're trying to do. It's give the guy options, teach him how to have those instincts and how to have those feels to be successful. And I really believe it can be taught. So that's what I started to do. I started organizing the website based on how I teach it and what I was doing at the time. And I build it out from there with lesson plans and everything. And I really believe, like, if you look around the country, if you pull up the top base stealing teams in the NCAA, Division One, Division Two is a little more rare. Division Three, junior college, like, members are all through there. And so, like, it clicks for people. You do have to put time in it. You got to invest it every day in practice. I mean, I just told you, we hijacked the conditioning to start to do it. You know, not every place the strength coach is going to be happy with that move. So we invested a lot of time and a lot of work, but it pays off. When guys are running, we get more fastballs, we get better opportunities to score. We teach our hitters our hitters know what a good jump looks like. They know when he's going to be safe. I just told you we're low risk. So most of the time, if we're taking off, he knows. So unless he's got like two strikes, averages go up as we advance bases and everything else goes up. I mean, last year we stole a ton of bases. And if you look at it, like, through the whole year, I called the offensive game. I didn't give one steal sign all year. So that's all on feel. It's all on having guys that
can
do it.
That's the best way, though, for sure.
It's hard. I mean, people don't understand. It's hard to steal when you ask them to.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to – I mean
– they have to feel it. Like you said, like, you're building a Swiss Army knife. Like, how tough is it to tell somebody, like, you have to use this certain thing right now? It's like, oh, I don't know. Like, if I wanted to use it, I would use it when I react because I know when I'm supposed to, right? Like, I'm not, like, predetermined. Like, all
right.
Like,
right.
You could give the guy a steal sign. The pitcher gives a look that, like, whatever the situation may be, that the guy's totally uncomfortable. Like, why would you force them to go? Versus what you're saying is, like, give them the tools to know when to, and they'll just do it.
Right. And I think, you know, and it's my belief, I think a lot of guys go the wrong direction. The same reason we were talking about drop stuffing. I think there's a lot of stuff, like, riddled through base running that we just do because the coach before us told us to do that, who just did it because, like, it's like the side thing. And the coach before him told him to do that. And it's just not, like, there wasn't real genuine thought put into it. So I do think sometimes guys focus on the wrong things, like, literally, like, they'll focus on the wrong body part, the wrong, you know, versus trying to develop those feelings. They try to guess versus trying to develop feelings. And that it's hard to explain because it's a feel. But if you work on it enough, it's amazing what you can get guys to do and how you can get them to react. And it can be a real, real headache playing a team that can do it top to bottom. Because if you think about it, you know, in a team like ours last year, we definitely had guys in the lineup that weren't very good at base. Like, their Swiss Army knife wasn't great. However, that might be a fast guy. It's going to steal 10 just because he's fast. So he gives a perception. The whole team has a perception of, like, hey, the catcher gets on. It's definitely not going, but he went once when the recipe was there for him to be successful. And now he's getting pickoff attempts and he's got no intentions of going.
Yeah.
So it's inviting you, and it's inviting more of the pitcher specifically to come play this game that you don't want to worry about playing.
Yep.
Now, if you're really good at
holding
the running
game, it's never in the back of your mind, right? Like, the catcher never steals. Like, now I have to worry about that.
Right, exactly. And now we get multiple pickoffs. He's not going. We increase the chance you might throw one away. But more important, like, you're worried about it because they generalize when they talk about playing my Wright State teams. It's generalized. Hey, these guys run. You know, and it wasn't true. It's hard because you don't get to announce who's a runner and who isn't. You can't look at stat because you assume because this guy had one stolen base. You could fall into your patterns, and he's smart. He trains just like everybody else, takes a bag, and you can't get it back. There's no redo. So, like, we really played exciting brand of baseball, and I tried to put that and organize it in my website, my book, and I have a lot of fun doing it. You know, it's still something I try to do and I try to keep up with every day, but I built it out and I'm proud of it. And I think I'm happy with the feedback I've got from people who have joined through the last 4 years. So,
yeah, for sure. I think that's, hey, listen, it says a lot. Like, you know, I'm lucky enough to be in an industry where, you know, proving that you're good at what you do is really easy in terms of, you know, the numbers, it being a number driven, industry, like metrics, like, you know, is your programming effective? Let's look at the numbers and what we tested. Like, it's really easy to show somebody, hey, you know, I'm a good strength coach, you know, and it's fortunate because if you are one, you'll be found. And I always like to say that, like, if you're a good strength coach and you can, you know, kind of, you know, jot down what you're doing, the results you're getting, and then show it to somebody, like, the proof is right there. And I think that it's kind of cool to see that, you know, something such as base dealing, like with there being a process like that, what you do that goes into it and all that kind of stuff. Like, there are numbers to show, like, hey, like the rate of which they're successful, the number of bags, like it's definitely there to show that it is effective. And I think that's super important. But two things that, and I guess we can kind of like, you know, leave off this way and you can kind of give us, you know, wrap this into some parting thoughts, but you had two, you know, interesting things on your site that I wanted to kind of touch on and get your feedback on. You mentioned, you know, Okay. Obviously aggressiveness, which is what you talked about a little bit now, but you know, you talked about a lot of stealing the base. A lot of stealing the base isn't even on the catcher. And you also mentioned that, you know, your first year, I think it was, you mentioned on your website, your first year at Wright State, like you didn't really even have any guys that were running below a 6'8" maybe or whatever. And you stole a lot of bags. Like, you know, take us through those two things. Like, why isn't a lot of it on the catcher? And, you know, you already kind of alluded to this already, but like, you know, what are some things for some, you know, maybe guys listening, like how can you be an effective base stealer when you're not naturally, you know, a gifted quote unquote fast runner?
Yeah. Before I started doing that, it's funny you mentioned that first team at Dayton. And I,
was that Dayton?
Some of those players are out. Well, my first year at Dayton, at Wright State, I definitely had faster runners than my first year at Dayton. And my first year at Dayton, I think we had one guy maybe arguably below 6'8", but, and he stole 36. He was like third in the country. But it was more guys like, there's a guy who's an assistant at Clemson right now, Jared Broughton, who stole, I want to say it was like 12 for 12. If you think of it, that doesn't sound as cool as 36, but he's going to be in the top of most conferences that year. And he probably won't like me saying this, but he's a 7-0 guy, right? CJ Gilman, who's now just took the job as a hitting coordinator with the Red. He was on that team. He was like a 7-0 guy, like big, strong guy. And he stole 21, I think, his first year. So like some of those, that team's really neat because you talked about not having any fast guys, but we did have some smart guys that are out there with this. Jimmy Raisinger, who's at Air Force right now. I mean, guys that are out there doing it now and taking it with them, it's pretty cool. I believe that the pitcher is who we capitalize on the majority of the time. Now, we'll take whatever you give. If it's a catcher with a poor arm, or a catcher that we think we can take advantage of, they're not as frequent as the pitchers. So like the pitchers are easier to read. They give you more information before the game starts. Catcher, you can get a pop time and all that, which we're definitely taking that information. And if he's average and the pitcher's average, that obviously helps us. But generally the pitcher in his rhythm and his habits allow us to be successful. And I don't want this to be mistaken for guessing. It's not like I can tell when he's going home. I think that's the wrong thing to do. I think he might lean a little bit. I think that's the wrong thing to do. It's a weird feeling that's developed based on patterns that he likes to do. That's not 1-1000, 2-1000 go, but that, you know, that we can start, you know, getting momentum. We can get good breaks. He likes throwing breaking balls in these counts. We're going to be over aggressive in these counts and make the catcher throw us out on breaking balls, things like that, and any and all of it too. So it adds up. It doesn't just stop at one. I think pitchers have certain tendencies with their looks at second. And those, once you start watching, like I worked with a guy, his name's Grant Witherspoon. He was like a third rounder from Tulane, who's with the Rays. And he came out and worked with me last year. And I remember he texted me during the World Series and he said, "You've made this miserable to watch," because he can't stop watching the head turns of the pitcher. And I can't believe how things are. And he stole 20 some bags this year. I had his best year this year. Because you pick up these things and it just keeps growing. As long as you're willing to be a student, you'll start picking these things up. So I really believe watching the pitcher pays off much more in much more cases than the catcher.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it makes sense when you explained it. Like, I was kind of curious as to, you know, what went into all that. But, you know, that's kind of where it all originates. And it definitely makes sense for sure. So I mentioned when I gave you that question, kind of like tying it into your parting thoughts, I kind of always give my guests the opportunity to leave off with anything that, you know, that they either didn't get to talk to or talk about, I'm sorry, you know, or anything that they wanted to discuss, or just leave the listener with. So floor is open to you if there was, there was anything in that regard.
No, I mean, first of all, I appreciate you having me on. Like, absolutely. I said, stumbling across your podcast, like, I love good information. I think it's such an awesome time. I know people are now complaining a little bit about some of the trash that's on Twitter from a baseball standpoint. But I do think it's a great time because you're getting free information and the stuff you're giving out. I appreciate it. And I appreciate you having me on. I definitely think, you know, I'm very lucky because people like you have given back. And I think I try to do that as much as I can, whether it's speaking at different places and actually giving real stuff and not like giving like a generic thing just to hold things back. To draw people to my website or something like that. And I think, you know, Mike Roberts did that for me, who's a mentor of mine. And to me, you can't be a base running guy or claim you're a base running guy without knowing who he is or without at least following his son, Brian Roberts, who in my opinion is like just my favorite guy to watch. But yeah, you know, I always mention him when I speak because he means a lot to me and I'm very appreciative of him and I wouldn't be where I am without him. So, him and, you know, other coaches I've had along the way that I've got to play for, coach for, work with. So, really, I just feel really lucky and I appreciate you having me on to help. Hopefully I can help, help the process for you a little bit. I don't know. Maybe we give some good information for some people.
Yeah.
And,
absolutely.
Draw people to watch some of your, go back and listen to some of your previous episodes because they're all very good. So, man, I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. You know, everything that, you know, means a lot. I mean, obviously excited to get this out. You know, it's the first episode I've had with, you know, someone in this specific area. So I was thrilled. And obviously, you know, your background speaks volumes. So thank you for coming on and I appreciate it. And obviously, you know, we're going to keep talking and keep bouncing things off each other. And I'm excited for kind of what that yields for both of us. So thanks again. And I appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm excited to get with you and work with you and keep in contact. So thanks again.
Absolutely, man. Thanks. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Muscles and Management Podcast brought to you by Challenger Strength. I'm your host, Jared DeFilippo, signing off on the show that's changing the way we view training, sports performance, and business.